Welcome to my platform, metro.co.uk's new podcast, where we speak to the authors of some of our first person and opinion section's most read articles of the past few years. My platform is all about drawing attention to underheard and underrepresented voices in the media, with guests talking about issues close to their heart, hosted by me, Jess Austin. I edit the section of the Metro that all of our lovely guests submitted their pieces to. As well as being among the most popular articles, they're also some of my absolute favourites, and I can't wait to speak to the authors more about what inspired their pieces, unhindered by a pesky word count. In this series, we'll be having thought-provoking discussions about issues like the pension gap, pretty privilege, and the problematic side of fake tanning. We'll also be shining a light on people's lived experience, covering mental health, HIV diagnoses, and finding love after loss. This week, we're welcoming Raj Singh Renu to the podcast. Raj is the owner of Sikh Wills, a will writing business for the Sikh community. Today, we're going to be discussing his story, which he shared with metro.co.uk in an article called "I Never Planned to Remarry After My Wife Died. When I Did, I Was Shamed for It." Hi, Raj. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast and also for sharing your story with us. It really, really resonated with our readers, and I hope you saw a kind of positive response in people reaching out. For those who haven't read your story, would you be able to tell me a bit more about yourself?
So, like you mentioned in the intro, Raj Singh Renu. I live in a town called Leamington Spa, which is right in the centre of England. I've got three young children. Now they are 13, so my oldest daughter is Naveen, and my middle daughter, Abani, she is 10, and my son is going to be 8 on Sunday. It was just going through my journey and what I went through the last four or five years. Unfortunately, my wife, Nim, she had passed away in 2018 at the age of 34, leaving me to bring up three young children. At the time, they were 9, 5, and 3. It's been a very, very, very tough journey where I am today. Life is good. Life is pretty amazing.
I'm glad to hear it. And so can we start by talking a bit about Nim? I really love the story about how you met. She was working in River Island at the time?
Yeah, I tell everyone we met on an island, but it's actually River Island. Yeah, so she had a part-time job working weekends in the shoe department, River Island. And my cousin worked there as well. I walked him and I said to my cousin, "Who's that over there? She's all right." And my cousin said, Oh, that's Nim. I was like, "Yeah, she's good. Yeah, she's nice. When are you going to talk to her?" No. Oh, I was a bit shy. I was 15, 16 years old, I was. But I went in the next week and I thought, right, built up a bit of courage. I thought, I'm going to go over. Walked over. I said, you know, like Joey from Fred, like, "How are you doing?" But she wasn't having any of it. I did persevere for a few weeks, and then eventually we swapped numbers. We just got to know each other as friends. She was at university in Kiel. I was up in Manchester, and we would just meet in the summer as friends. But in my final year of university, I had called her and I said, "Look, can you come up to Manchester?" She got really worried. She got the train. When she got to the train station, she got a cab to my house where I was staying. She goes, "You okay?" I said, "Okay, what about you and me?" She's like, "What are you on about? You and me?" She goes, "Well, like, get together." I'm like, "Yeah." And then she hit me like that. She goes, "Well, I thought somebody had died or you needed money." I was like, "Well, I need money because I'm a student." But that's it. We just got together, when she came up, you know, we went out to a cinema. It was really, really nice, you know, just being together as a couple. But she literally helped me, you know, financially through university and with my degree as well. I wouldn't have got a degree, but that's how we met.
And so from the minute you got together, so you got married in 2008, what was life like for the both of you up until her diagnosis?
It was, we were married for 10 years we were together. Life was very, very busy because we got married at age 24, and then we had Naveen at age 25, and then Avani came at age 29, and then Biren came at age 31. So it was all go, go, go. So school runs, nurseries. And I remember just sitting there. We both sat there. We just need a break. Cannot wait. She said, I cannot wait. 2018, be when it's going to be in nursery. And then for about 3 hours during the day, we'll have no children. We were looking forward. We were counting down, you know, the years, the months, the days until that moment.
And then she started experiencing symptoms. Did either of you think it could be cancer at the time? What kind of symptoms was she experiencing?
No, absolutely not. So it's around about March 2017. We were all sat around the dinner table, and it was in the evening. And she was eating, and when she swallowed her food, she started getting a bit of pain. What in the chest here? Are you okay? She was, yeah, I'm fine. I'm fine. Thought it might be indigestion. But this happened for a couple of days. And then, so maybe you should get it checked out. She goes, I'll get it checked out. A couple of weeks later, I said, have you booked an appointment with the doctor? And she said, no. I said, look, I've noticed a couple of times now that the way you're eating, it is, you're getting quite a few pains here. And she said, oh, yeah, I know. I said, make sure you book an appointment. Next day when I was at work, I just checked in with her. WhatsApp to her. I said, oh, have you made an appointment? She said, yeah, I've done it. A couple of days later, and the doctor said it was acid reflux. So he gave her some tablets for about 3-4 months. And so she was taking that, but the pain was still there. But the thing that did it for us was that she was losing a lot of weight. So if she couldn't eat, she wasn't gaining any weight. She was actually a lot of weight loss. So she went back. And when the doctor saw how much weight she lost, I think for him, alarm bells, right, let's refer you to a consultant at the hospital, get some various tests done. And then that's what they did. So he referred us to a consultant, did various tests, ultrasounds, x-rays, everything, but nothing came on. But it was in December 2017, about a week before Christmas, they did a biopsy of the stomach. And it's very, very bizarre. To this day, I don't know why the doctor said this. Is that she went in for the biopsy. I was hanging around. And then when she messaged me, I'm done. And then when I came to pick her up, the doctor said, if it's okay, I'd rather not give you the results. I was like, why on earth did he say that? And in my head, I was like, this is serious now. He should not have said that. And then I don't know whether she heard him or she just kept her thoughts or feelings to herself, but me and that. Then we got a letter, got Christmas out of the way, got New Year's, and we got a letter on the 2nd or 3rd of January saying, oh, can you come in for another biopsy? So went in 2 days later and did another biopsy. About 4 or 5 days after that, we got called in with the consultant, and they said, you've either got TB, it's an infection, or it's a tumour. And we were like, what? So obviously you think the worst. And then we went in a couple of weeks later. I remember we had a cousin's wedding at the end of January, and it was the day before she went in, and the consultant was sat there and said, look, we've looked at all the results, we've analysed everything, and unfortunately, you've got cancer. It's in the stomach. Your life is cut short. There's no treatment. We'll ever get rid of it. And then I just looked at him. She looked at me, and she burst into tears. We were like, wow. We didn't know what to say. So there was a moment of silence when the consultant was talking, but it just wasn't registering. Went back to the car, about to start the engine. I ran back in. Okay, I'll be back in 1 second. I forgot to ask the oncologist something. So I ran back in. I said, how long has she got left? They said, do you really want to know? I said, yeah. She probably got 18 months, 2 years left. Then walked back to the car. And she said, what did you ask the consultant? I said, I just wanted to ask about what the next step is, treatment wise. And I kept that to myself. I didn't tell anyone. I thought, nasty. How am I going to deal with this? I mean, you think the worst case scenario, children, how are we going to tell them family wise? So up until that point, the whole life changed. Everything changed. Outlook on life.
Yeah. And afterwards, so Nim underwent some treatments to try and prolong her life, but she got infections, delayed treatments more and more. And you mentioned that she started becoming withdrawn. How did that impact you as a couple and you yourself?
Yeah, so she, because she couldn't eat, they said, look, we need to do chemotherapy. However, your weight is 41, 42 kilos. You need to gain about 6 kg to do the chemo. But that's what they did. They put a tube in a small bowels, and then she was fed liquid food every night. So we would get deliveries of liquid food in a pouch, put it in the machine, and the kids were like, we're like, what are the kids going to think? And they were like, wow, that's so cool. You know, we thought, okay. You know, they're not scared. So, yeah, so she gained a bit of weight. We did a bit of research, and then we chose to do immunotherapy. Some family members said, no, do the chemotherapy. We were like, no, we've done our research. So we went to Nottingham Hospital, and then they did again various tests. They said, there's an infection in the liver. There's a buildup of bile. We need to do a small incision, and we can release all the bile, and then we can go ahead with the treatment. Very simple procedure. The surgeon doctor who was telling us how it works, he was overconfident, very cocky. And then when he came out of the small procedure, she was in so much pain. I've never, ever, ever seen her like this. Her drug card was empty, so the doctor forgot to put what drugs that she needed. The wards were all full, so she was in the labour suite. So it was a right circus, to be honest. And I just wanted to break down and cry, because seeing your wife, you know, go through that much pain. So it kind of all went downhill from there. And then that small procedure, which didn't go right, caused her temperature to fluctuate from 38 to 43. And the doctors just couldn't get that right. So the focus was on the liver, not on the cancer. So she was just in and out of hospital. Sometimes you'll stay up to 2 months in hospital. So, you know, from where I live in Leamington to Nottingham, it's an hour and a half, you know. And so that was a challenge. So it was a lot of shift work between families and the kids and me being there, me being at home, children's school runs. Because, you know, they were like, where's mommy? When's mommy coming back? And why is she not here? So where's daddy? Can't daddy take us to school? So it took a strain on financially as well, because I'm self-employed, and Nim was self-employed, and she didn't get any benefits, any sick leave or sick payment or anything like that. So financially and mentally, and it was a strain on all of our relationship.
And how did the kids cope? I assume you obviously didn't tell them about her prognosis, but did you tell them that she had cancer? Were you open, or were they too young?
So we didn't tell them when she was in hospital, we didn't tell them she had cancer. We said, like, mummy's not well, but the doctors are trying to fix her. We spent quite a few months in Nottingham, so they just couldn't get it right. So we said we want to transfer her to Coventry, more local to home. And that was only 20, 25 minutes away. And so the kids saw her more often. Then they discharged her. They said, stay at home, but then we'll get the nurses to come home. So she spent time with the children. Children spent time with her, but she just didn't have the energy to walk, get out and about. Nurses would come home every day, about three times a day, but they could see that mummy wasn't well. I never mentioned the word cancer to them, because you mention that and everyone freaks out. But I don't want to scare them. And they said, mummy's not well, but the doctor tried really hard to make her better. And it's only when there was one point when she got really bad, and they said that we need to do radiotherapy. If it doesn't work, she's got about 6 weeks left to live. And that's when I thought, like, kids, mommy's not well, but there could be a chance that she could go to God in heaven, you know, in the sky. And I remember telling Naveen, again, she was nine at the time, she just turned nine, burst into tears, locked herself in her room, just trying to console her. Amani, who was five, and B, when he was three, he had no idea. I didn't mention anything about mummy going to God in the sky. So that mummy's not well, but the doctors are really trying hard to fix her. And so that was tough telling them that. But it got to the point in August. So we had just celebrated that 10-year wedding anniversary. I remember she wanted a chocolate diamond ring. So I'm going to the shop, choosing. I said, yep, here's the size that I need. Can I get this? And she's like, oh, lucky lady. Who's it for? I said, oh, it's for my wife. In anniversary? I said, yeah, 10 years. I said, oh, but she'd be excited to wear that. You know, when you put that on her. And just all that happiness and joy just left my body. And she could see that something was wrong. And she said, are you okay, sir? I said, not really. I said, yeah, 10 years we've been married. But she's currently in hospital, fighting for her life. She's got cancer. And the doctor said, we don't know how long she's got left. And I remember just giving it to her in the bag. She knew what it was. She put it on. I put it on her finger. She gets, she said, come here, give me a hug, give me a kiss. And there was no happiness, no joy there. It's just a weird feeling. Really, really weird feeling.
You mentioned that obviously it started the, well, Nim might have not known the prognosis. She obviously knew things weren't going, treatment wasn't going well, and she started becoming withdrawn, especially from the kids, because it was so hard. What was that like for both of you?
So when in 2017, when I went in to ask how long she got left, it said 18 months, 2 years. So I didn't tell anyone. When she got transferred to Coventry, the consultant there was very black and white, very blunt, straight to the point, looked at the notes. I thought, this is like within 15 minutes of us arriving there. Looked at the notes, she said, do you know you've only got 12 months left? And I looked at him, I looked at her, and I in my head, I was like, what did you just say to her? And Nim was like, look, she goes, okay. She goes, but I'll do whatever it takes to fight it. And I was like, yes, you know, good, she's taking it. And that's it, she didn't cry or anything. That was the first time, you know, somebody put that she heard, like, I've only got a certain amount of time left. But again, there was no treatment. All the focus was on the temperatures on the liver. And it just got to the point where, in August, after I gave her the ring, the doctor said, there's nothing we can do. You know, we might as well go home. Or do you want to go into hospice? We were dead against hospice. We said, no, definitely not that. Because she had spent so much time away from the children. We thought, come home. She was adamant because I was saying, no, go to hospice, it's very nice. We're like, no. Again, she was very, do this, do that. And then Nim's mum was there. She goes, look, there's always hope. You know, she can fight this, she can fight this. And the consultant got annoyed and she turned to Nim's mum and said, you do know she's going home to die. And I was like, oh. And I got so angry. And even Nim was like, no, I'm going to fight this. So then I remember going home, prepping all of her siblings, all the family that were there. I said, look, this is what's happening. So she's coming home. She's not going to hospital. So just keep her comfortable. But do whatever you do, not cry or get upset in front of her. So they all, you know, cried. The advantage that I had is that I work, obviously, will write end of life planning, but I've also had experience of working in the funeral industry. So I've gone to people's houses and the mortuary and prep, you know, they picked up corpses for the funeral and dressed, you know, dead bodies, you know, before the funeral and bathed them and all sorts. So I, in my head, I was playing a little movie, but the consultant said this, so I've got to be prepared. She's going to come home, she's going to pass away, call the funeral directors, and they're going to take her away. So I was mentally prepared for all of that. And I can't pass that knowledge on to anybody else because they haven't been through it. So they were all a wreck. And then when all I remember is that she heard coming off the ambulance, stretched on a bed. She literally is coming home tonight. And she came in and people were just there trying to hold back the tears. They're turning away, crying. And it's made her comfortable. And she was very stubborn. She goes, I don't want a hospital bed at home. I don't want this. But when she walked into, well, when she got wheeled into the room, she could see the hospital bed. She looked at me and said, it's for your own benefit. And then just over time, there was withdrawal from everyone, but especially the children. I could understand that, but other family members couldn't. They're like, Nim, come on, go say hello, go and give the kids a hug. And Nim just didn't have the energy. In my head, I was like, okay, she knows she is dying. She does not want to give them false hope. Give them lots of hugs and cuddles. knowing that she is going to die and the kids are going to be like, where's mommy? So this is why slowly she decided to detach herself from everyone, including me.
Yeah, but you mentioned being taken aback when she asked you not to marry again afterwards. And obviously you said that wasn't even something you were considering at that point. But how did it feel for her to say that? And can you tell me what happened?
So her family member came to me. I was in the kitchen. She's upset. And then, you know, when like your bottom lip starts quivering and you're about to cry, she's like trying to hold back the tears. And I'm like, what's wrong? Someone said something. Someone upset you. She goes, no. And she just held my hand. And she said, promise me you will never get married again. And I looked at her and thought, why are you saying that? Of course I won't. That was the last thing on my mind. I thought, how can I bring another woman into the kids' lives? Right? And I know that is what she was thinking. She goes, no other person can come into the kids' lives. No one can do a better job as a mother than she could do. And that's what that was going through her mind. And I said, I reassured her, I said, I promise you, I won't get married again. And she was like, all right, we had a hug, give a kiss on the forehead, I sat with her for a bit, watched a bit of Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmare, because that's what we watched in hospital, and just chilled. And then I remember it, it's a very hot summer day, but sun was shining right on her back. So that was in August. So again, she was to and from hospital. And when she got sent home from the hospital, that was first week of September. And then she had passed away on the 19th of September, 11:30 even, a few days before. I said, look, I said to Naveen, and I said to all three of them, to be honest, I said, look, mommy's not well. There will be a time when she'll go to God in the sky. And finally, again, not much of a reaction of either, but, oh, the doctor's trying to fix her up. Yeah. She passed away on the 19th of September, 11:30 at night. What should have been very peaceful, it most definitely wasn't. It is probably very, very stressful, the way she passed away. It was like a circus. That's the best way I can describe it. And the kids were literally just upstairs, a lot of people wailing, crying, screaming. I'm surprised the kids didn't hear it all. And all I remember is I had like an out-of-body experience where I just came out and I was in the corner of the room and I was just looking, scanning the room. What the hell is going on? What's going on here? And I don't know how long I was there for, but I just came back and I just said, stop, everyone stop. Because I tried to resuscitate her. Then they put back on the bed. And I said, look, she's gone. She's not coming back. Then everyone kind of calmed down and I just looked up and there were like more family members there all just seeing what's going on, what's happening. So I said, I walked out of the room. I let them just have their part, how they want to say goodbye. And I just called the funeral directors because, again, I knew what to do. And this is a friend of mine who owned the funeral directors. I said, Manny, I need you. This is about, and I called him. 11:30, I called about midnight. I said, mate, I need you to come to my house. You don't do anything right. I said, look, my wife, she's passed away. And you know when, because in the middle of the night, and as soon as I said that, I could see in my head that he had just sat up in bed. He had, well, I said, yeah, my wife, she's passed away. I said, mate, if you can get here for about 1:30, I thought that's enough time for people to say their goodbyes. Someone made a phone call to another family member. And that person told someone, and next minute, you know, at 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm getting messages saying, look, I've just heard about me. What happened? I'm so sorry. And my inbox, my WhatsApp, everything was full. But 1:30, funeral directors came, and I said to everyone, look, she's going to go now. They're like, oh, why did you call them? Why is she going so quickly, so early? It was a traumatic experience where she passed away. I did not want that to carry on. I didn't want to disturb the children. So they came. They brought a trolley in, opened the body bag on the floor, and two of them just put her in there, and they just zipped her, put her back on, put her in the back of the van, and they drove off. And I remember my mum just tapping me on the back saying, look, why don't you cry? Come on, son, why don't you cry? I said, I physically cannot cry, and I don't feel like crying. And again, it's because I knew this was going to happen, so I was mentally prepared for it. And then that morning, And then it was and then it was just, because when you walk down the stairs, as soon as you look to the left, there was that new room where she was staying. And you could see her. And then we came downstairs, looked in the room. She said, "Daddy, where's Mummy?" I said, "Mummy's now with God in this world." She said, "What?" I said, "She's now gone." She burst and she ran upstairs, closed the door behind her, and she was on the floor crying. And I just walked in, closed the door behind me, and I just gave her a hug. And she burst into tears. I wanted to say to her, "Naveen, everything's going to be okay." But I thought, that's a lie. I don't know if everything's going to be okay or not. So we were there for a good 15, 20 minutes, just consoling her. Then Naveen wakes up. I'm downstairs at this point. She walks downstairs, looks in the room, looks around. "Where's Mummy?" "Mummy's now gone in the sky." She continues, walks into the other room, sits on the sofa, gets the remote control, puts her telly on. "So how did Mummy go into the sky?" So Navani God came down and said, "Navani," actually, God came down and said, "Come on, Mummy, it's time for you to come up now. But before you go, give the kids a kiss goodnight." So Mummy came to your bedroom to give you a kiss, and then she flew into the sky. Yeah, no reaction. Then she said, "Daddy, but yeah, can we FaceTime Mummy?" And my heart sank. So look, Mummy's left her phone, it's right there. And then that's what I gave her a hug, and I just burst into tears, but I was trying to hold them in. But that was a turning point for me. So again, I didn't console her. I felt as if I needed consoling from her after what she just said. That was tough. That was very, very tough. And then we've got Vera, again, who's 3 years old, has no idea what death means. "Where's Mummy?" I said, "Mummy's now with God in the sky." "Okay, when's she coming back?" I said, "Vera, Mummy's never coming back." "Doctor's trying to fix her?" I said, "No, they tried, but they couldn't." Again, he couldn't get his head around it. "Mummy's with God in the sky?" I said, yeah, she blew up. And then he would stand in the window, look up and say, "I miss you, Mummy. When are you coming back? Love you, Mummy." 34 days straight. That's what he was saying. "When Mummy coming back?" They were so hard. They were so tough. Because after the funeral, everyone leaves you alone. Nobody's there for you to. You're dealing with all of this yourself. So that was a very, very challenging time. We're just trying to explain to the children. That's the hardest thing I've done, is tell them, "Right, Mummy's on, she's never coming back." Definitely the most hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
Yeah, because on the one hand, through your job, you know the next steps, you know what needs to be done. So doing that, the logical, mechanical steps probably came not easier to you, but you just knew that what you had to do. But the emotional side is completely, there's no way you can predict or plan or try and work out how to deal with your emotions and other people's emotions. And you mentioned that you try to keep on a brave face outside the home and in front of your kids, but you just had so many evenings where you just cried by yourself and tried to keep strong for everyone else, but couldn't when you were by yourself.
And I definitely think by me being strong for everybody else, it did help people around me. But there were times in the evenings when the kids would put them to bed, I'd come down and I'd think, right, what do I do? There's only so much Netflix you can watch, there's only some TV, so I'd just crack open a bottle of wine or vodka, whatever it might be. And I'd just have a few glasses of them. And I remember waking up in the morning, 7 o'clock, trying to put it on snooze, 7:30, kids, come on, we've got to get up for school. "Dad, I can't find my skirt. Dad, I can't find this." And I'm like, frantically trying to look for it. And then I just remember just dropping the kids off, all the parents looking at me. So that's where I prayed at school, is that they sent letters out to all the parents to say, "Look, this is what's happened. Don't approach the family. Let them grieve. Give them space. Be respectful." That helped a lot. Definitely helped. But you just know, so I'm just there and mark it up. Don't want to talk to her. I'm hungover. I was like, right, got a beer off. I said, I've got 3 hours till I pick him up again and go home and just watch rubbish. That was tough. That was so tough.
And you and Nim had discussed kind of parenting and how she wanted the kids to be raised after she passed away. What did she say, and kind of how did you make sure that her wishes were being followed?
So it was, she got she wrote 3 letters for the children. It took me months to actually read them because I didn't know what was in them. And when we went to scatter the ashes, we got necklaces and pendants maybe with their fingerprints and handprint. And I gave the letters to the kids. And B was sat on my lap, and I went to read it. I just could not read it. Just so upsetting to read. But I only had the, I think I only read it in the last 18 months. I burst into tears. So I've actually got a letter here. So this was what Nim wrote. It starts off with saying that, look, sister, help me write this to you because I'm not well enough to write it myself. Firstly, we put B's in it. Mummy wants to say thank you. Thank you for completing our little family, for filling my heart with so much love and happiness. I wanted you for such a long time. When I found out that you were growing in my tummy, it made my day so bright. I've never felt prouder of having you as my son, my baby boy. I love you so much, my darling. You have been so funny and kind, gentle and loving. Before I was ill, especially during, you are the most perfect little boy I could have hoped to have found. I'm very poorly at the moment, my darling. I know you've seen Mummy change a lot. It hasn't been a day that I haven't thought about you, and there won't ever be. I'm trying my best to get well for you and your sisters. I know it's very hard to see me change and feel as though things are very different. The doctor's been trying very hard to help Mummy, and I know you have too. But sometimes these things happen and we can't change it. You've seen a lot in your 3 years, Miriam. You've made me smile every day. You've met all the nurses and you are helping me, and they've all seen your guns. You've put your gloves on to help me check my head, check my temperature, and rub my arms. You've helped me massage my legs. You have been with me every day, and I will still be with you. Your family loves you very much, and they will be there for you whenever you feel scared or worried or upset, especially Daddy. I think it's tough to read this. Even if you can't see me, I will always be listening and watching over you. I've always been very proud of you, and I'll always be with you. You are so kind. Caring that made me smile every day. Always be proud of who you are and what you will become. You are my littlest baby, but you have shown me what a big boy you are and how you will be as you are growing up. Being the youngest means you have 2 big sisters to love you too and share our memories and stories with you. We will always have each other. Biren, my darling. Mummy might be too weak to fight this illness. If I am and the medicines don't work, then I'll be safe with God in the sky. I'm sorry I won't be there to help you, but I promise I will be there forever. You will always be in my heart no matter what. I hope one day when you're old enough that you can understand why I had to go, but that I would never have chosen this. I love you so much, my special boy. I hope you remember these 3 years for the happiness and love we shared in the family. I love you more than we'll ever know. My gorgeous prince, all my love forever. Mummy. Oh, that was tough.
Parenting, I suppose, as your kids got older, you mentioned that, you know, it impacted your children differently as well, losing her. One of your daughters became very quiet afterwards. How was that? How did you make sure that they always felt listened to and supported?
They were all grieving in different ways. They got Naveen, to be honest. She would be quiet at school, wouldn't really mention anything. She'd carry on as normal. But then she would be open, draw pictures at home. And say, I really miss mommy. You know, I miss how she did my hair. And then we got a Barney. It was the opposite. Wouldn't talk to anyone, very quiet. But she would express how she felt by drawing at school, making things, making like a memory box. And that's how she dealt with it. And I can kind of relate to that. So, for example, if there was like a situation where something funny was happening, she would laugh and then she would hold herself back. And I feel as if I am like that. I used to be like the joker of the family, life and soul of the party, but that got taken away after Nim had passed away. So I've been doing a bit of reflection for quite some time now. And I'm thinking, that's the person I miss, have a laugh and a joke. And I felt as if, like, as I was bringing up the three children, I couldn't have a laugh. I couldn't be funny. I had to put structures and routines and systems in place so I could get the kids through life, like wake them up at a certain time. And if you look at them now, you think, and mommy didn't pass away, you know, 4 years ago. Absolutely not. And so that's worked on that side. But for me, I've had to be somebody else. But I actually miss that old person of me, what I was like when Nim was here. And I'm working on myself to be that person again, rather than stressing over little tiny things, just to be a bit more present with children.
And you started writing about kind of the challenges you faced as a single widowed parent on LinkedIn. I think you mentioned that you were having a dilemma about what to do when your daughters need the loo. Do you take them to the ladies' toilet, or do you, you know, send them in one at a time? Why did you turn to LinkedIn, and kind of how did that help you?
When you're in a relationship, whether it's partners, marriage, you have that companion. And my companion had gone. There were times when I'd come back from the gym and I'd normally call Nim or text and say, look, going past the supermarket, do you need anything? I thought, I can't do that anymore. So I was craving to talk to someone. And I found that my laptop, writing articles on LinkedIn was a good way for me to let out what I wanted to say to them. And it's very, well, it went down really well. Really, really well. So I thought, I had a good response to this. Write another one. And then it's just progressed from there. And here we are.
And through LinkedIn, you met Palm. How did she get in touch and what was she saying?
It was, yeah, so somebody, one of my connections on Instagram has shared a link to my story. And then she read it. And then she said, tell you what, why don't we go away on holiday? And I'll take care of the kids. I thought, what a bizarre thing to say, you know, you take care of me. But that's really kind of you. Really, really kind. And then we she would like my stories, comment on them. Didn't think anything of it. She said, look, I'm divorced. I've got three young kids myself. I need to make a will. So I thought, okay. So we arranged a meeting, went to meet her to discuss all what she wants to write in a will and so on. But we were there for 4 hours. We didn't even talk about the will. We hit it off straight away. This person's like a mirror. But it wasn't a case of, well, I'm going to be with that. This person's going to be in my life for a long time, you know, as a friend. Because again, I wasn't looking, you know, I made a promise to them, you know, I wasn't looking for anyone. But we hit it up straight away. And then we thought, oh, there's a circus going on, because she lived in Oxford, and I'm here in Leamington. Oh, there's a circus. Shall we get the kids together? Right, let's get the kids together. They got on straight away, and Vivian, he said, can we get back to Palm's house? I was like, Vera never says that about anyone. And I said, go and ask Palm then. Like, Palm, can we come back to your house? And I was like, of course you can. They went back to their house, we were chilled, had some food, made pizzas. I'm like, oh, okay, this is great. You know, the kids all get on with each other. This is really good. And then we met more and more. And then we had lockdown. You know, and that, but for some people, lockdown was a challenge. But for us, it's probably the best thing that could have happened to us. Because she sold her house in Oxford. She moved to Leamington. And then because we were in lockdown, no outsiders could come in and influence, you know, what was happening with us. So, again, when you're stuck in a house, you're living on top of each other, it can either push you apart or we can bring you together. It brought all of us together close. That was very good for us.
And when did you decide to transition from friendship to relationship? And you also mentioned that you were very keen to make sure that your kids were fully on board as well.
I've had quite a few people ask me that, and I really don't know the answer to that. At what point do we think, oh, okay, we're together now, we're a couple? I honestly don't know. We literally went with the flow, but there was a point where we were on our way back from Palm's house, and on the motorway, and we were at the front. And I thought, are you okay? She burst into tears. Daddy, what are you doing? We're trying to replace mommy. I don't like it. And like I said, we're not trying to do any of that. We're really not trying to do any of that. And then I had a conversation with Palmer. We were always set on day one that, like, it's all about the children getting on. If they don't, if they don't get on with either one of us, then we're just going to keep it as it is. But I asked Naveen a couple of weeks ago, Naveen, do you remember what you were like? She goes, oh my God, Daddy, don't mention that. It's so embarrassing. Can't believe I did that. I said, but it's not your fault. They're the emotions and emotion that you were going through. But now you look at her, you look at Palm, inseparable. That, they literally are like mother and daughter of the relationship.
And Palm made it very clear from the beginning that she knew she wasn't there to replace Nim. She wasn't there to try and destroy memories. She, in fact, there's a line in your piece saying she didn't want to move into your house originally because she didn't want to take over Nim's space. Did that just make you respect and value her more because she was so understanding of what you and your family had been through?
I was like, really? Is that what you want to do? She goes, yeah. Because you've got memories of Nim in the house. The kids see Nim in that kitchen. Yeah, the kids see you and Nim chilling on the sofa. All of you are playing games over Christmas. Because I don't want to ruin that. So my dad had another property which he rented out, and tenants were leaving. And then, so she moved in there. And then me and Palm decided, okay, kids, like my kids were like, okay, you can each have a draw each. So if you want to stay over a couple of nights here, and then you can do that. First day they moved in, we stayed over. We never left. So we all moved in. There were eight of us in a small three-bedroom house. And it was great. We've got so many good memories all living together. So that was really, really good. And there were times when Palm was saying, just tell me about me. And at first, I'm like, why is she asking? She goes, because I want to know more about her. So it gives me more of an insight. What you were like, and the children, because Nim still lives within the kids. So tell me what she was like cooking wise, hair and makeup, you know, what were her hobbies. And so she was always asking questions at first. I thought, why? You know, is this normal? But, you know, and I'm so glad she did. Right now, as soon as you walk in our hallway, there's a big photo collage. It's got pictures of all of us. Picture of Nim, picture of me and Nim, and that's all Pam. That is all her. Got a big photo of Nim in the kitchen, and every time it's a kid's birthday, she'll pull that out, put it into the birthday cake, so she'll make sure that kids never ever forget her. Never forget her.
There was a example you mentioned in your piece as well about one of your children saying that they were worried about forgetting their mum, and Pam sat down and went through Nim's Instagram with the kids, and they draw her together and all of that. So I think that's just really beautiful.
Yeah, we are all blessed and lucky that we found someone like her that does things like this. she's had friends that have said to her, I couldn't do what you do. Really couldn't do what you do. Someone even said to her a few years ago, how are you going to compete with a dead woman? She goes, I'm not competing with anyone. I'm here to give this love to these children who need it, who deserve it. That's what I'm here for. And now, you know, you look at all of us, it's you could not tell that we are like a blended family. Two families have come together. They're all starting to look like each other as well now, you know. You just would not be able to tell that we're from two separate.
And can you tell me about Palm as a person? What's she like?
I think the way I've described her says a lot about her. Very, very, very caring. She will definitely 100% put all the other people around her first. She will forget about herself. I said, no, put yourself first. She's got a beautiful heart inside. I'm so grateful and blessed. And I do pray to God every day, saying, you know, thank you for putting someone like this in front of us. You know, it's like a breath of fresh air, like breathing life into all of us once again. And she is the main link between all of us, And that there was a time when she wasn't well. She was ill. We were like, oh my God, you know, everything's falling apart because she does literally everything. She's got this crazy system. You think about laundry in a house, right? The machine's on about 2-3 times a day. Dryers on 2-3 times a day. Ironing. Well, how do you do all of this? And the kids. And when food shopping. But I'm making it sound like I don't do anything. But it's not that. It's that she's got some kind of system in her head and it works. All works because of her.
And when did you decide that it was time to marry her?
3rd of July 2021, I want to say. It was just one of them, like, well, what's the point in just cohabiting, you know? Let's make it official. So we got married at the end of lockdown. So it's a very small, intimate wedding, which is perfect. Now, in the morning ceremony, we had 35 people there in the reception. We had 52 people there. So it was when they still had restrictions where you couldn't dance indoors. So we had a marquee outside. The World Cup was on, England versus Germany. So it was a good wedding.
Sorry if it's a slightly tricky question, but obviously, Nim, you'd made a promise to Nim. Did you have any kind of guilt when it came to marrying Palm, or did you realise that Nim probably would understand and that Palm was doing everything to honour her memory?
So if you look at when Nim said it, she was very, very emotional. In her head, it's about death. I'm going to leave everyone behind, especially my children. No one else can come in and do the job as Nim did. That's what was going through my head. But if you look at the way I've described Palm, if you look at where we live, photos of Nim, if you ask any of the kids, I don't have any regrets. Absolutely not. There isn't any guilt. There are people out there who are trying to make me feel guilty because maybe they feel guilty. But they're not living in my shoes. They're not bringing up the kids. They weren't there in the dark time when I had to do the ironing, the washing, cleaning, doing their homework, bathing them. You know, there were countless nights where I'm just by myself. They weren't there. They're not going through what I did or what I did. And it definitely 100% was the right choice. And the funny thing is, I was at the gym this morning and one of Nim's family members was there. And he goes, you know what? I'm so happy. There are people in our family that I've said, that don't agree with what you've done, but you absolutely 100% have done the right thing. I can see how happy you are. I can see how happy your kids are. So don't worry about anyone else. And I was like, that means a lot.
But you have mentioned there is, you've obviously experienced some stigma, which is why you and Palm have started using the blended Sikh family hashtag on Instagram. Do you mind telling me a bit about why you decided to start doing that?
How are we going to tell people? Because it's best to hear from the horse's mouth as opposed to from hearsay from other people, because they won't get the true picture and the true story. So we're a blended family. It is a taboo thing in our culture. We're Sikhs, one our blended Sikh family. So we put that on Insta, and I remember the first video that we put out was all of the kids in age order. So we had the camera mounted in my office, and we're all walking, running up to the camera. We'd do like a funny face, a little jump, and they'd all going in one by one. And people think, oh, is this line ever going to end? You know, and then there's me right at the end, with my hands like this, like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And then so many people like, congratulations, oh, this is amazing. We had a very, very, very good reaction. Like, this is exactly what we needed. And it has broken down barriers, opened doors for other people. Oh, I've got the meshes. Yeah, people have sent me on Instagram and Facebook. But you get that small minority. I've had fake profiles being set up, you know, have trolls message me. But at first I used to let it get to me. I said, oh, do you know what? If they were sat or stood in front of me, they wouldn't have the guts to say anything. And it's easy to be a keyboard warrior and come and say it to my face. So I don't let it bother me. Do not let it bother me. Even the comments that went up when I wrote the article for the Metro, it went down really well. But again, it's that small part of the community that weren't happy. But hey, life's short. And I'm not going to let it, you know, ruin my happiness from what I've got.
Amazing. And is there a message that you want our listeners to take home, or anything that we haven't touched on so far in the podcast?
Never give up. Do not give up. You'll get people saying, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. But firstly, look after number one, which is yourself. You can't pour from an empty cup, you know, and I did neglect myself for a short while, thinking that, no, I'm doing everything for the kids. But hang on, if my health is deteriorating, how am I going to look after them? So firstly, I'd say it's put yourself first, your happiness, your mental health. Never, ever, ever give up, because that is when, and I wrote it in LinkedIn article, is that if you fall, make sure you fall on your back, because if you fall on your back, you can look up and you can get up. And that's what's got me through all these tough times. And this is why I'm so happy. I can say life is great because of that.
Thanks for listening to my platform and to Raj's experience. You can find Raj on social media under Singspirational. Raj and his family were also supported by Marie Curie. Please leave us a rating and a review. It really helps people to find the podcast. Our main aim with this podcast is to give a platform to underheard voices, offering human-first stories. We'd love to hear if Raj's story helped shape your worldview. If so, please let us know on Twitter at MetroOpinion or by email at platform@metro.co.uk. My platform is produced by Pineapple Audio Production. I'm Jess Austin. Thanks for listening.